You're listening to a podcast from oxinabox.co.uk with Catherine McAllister.
Hi, I'm Klaus Kicheller. I'm an historian at the University of Oxford.
And I'm Samantha Vanderslot. I'm a sociologist also at the University of Oxford.
And we are here at the brand new Alice in Typhoid Land exhibition, which opens
on January 20th at the History of Science Museum and at the Western Library.
Now, this is an amazing project that you two have been undertaking for quite some time now. First of all, tell me why, I suppose, this specific subject that you've expanded in such an amazingly visual and complex way.
So we were brought to typhoid because of a recent trial that went on in Oxford to test a new vaccine for typhoid. And it got us thinking about, well, how was Oxford affected by typhoid in the past, and what does that mean for today? So Klaus is a historian and I'm a sociologist, and we joined forces to put on Alice in Typhoid Land. And Klaus could say a bit more about why Alice was the hook for this exhibition.
Yeah. So the more we conducted research on typhoid, both in the past and the present, the more we realized that Oxford's quite a special city for the history of typhoid. We found out that Oxford has this incredible story of Dean Henry Liddell, who was the father of the real Alice in Wonderland, Alice Liddell, who was one of the leading campaigners for sanitary reform in Oxford during this period. And together with his friend, Henry Ackland, one of the likely inspirations for the White Rabbit, he really pioneered the development of sweeping changes to the city's infrastructure.
I mean, it's quite amazing, isn't it, that basically people were dying in Oxford because it wasn't sanitary, and they hadn't made the link medically between typhoid being a waterborne disease or why people were dying, and yet they made these sweeping reforms. It wasn't chance, but it was definitely a punt. There was no definite proof. Is that the case?
So during the 19th century, lots of definitions of disease are really in flux. During the beginning of the 19th century, most people would have thought that typhoid is airborne. You'd contract it by inhaling bad-smelling air coming from putrefying matter. But what really starts happening from the mid-19th century onwards, after cholera hits nearly all of Europe and especially the UK in several waves, is that younger medical professionals start thinking about, well, can we actually focus on specific environments that may spread diseases like cholera, and typhoid is seen as a related disease? And what happens in Oxford is that Henry Ackland and his colleague William Omerod start creating these incredible maps that we also show in the exhibition, which really make the case for the fact that these diseases seem to be associated with poor drainage, poverty, and bad sanitary conditions. And that really is a game changer in the way authorities in Oxford start thinking about what they could do against the disease. And one of the solutions that is proposed during this period is really investing in new sewage infrastructure and drinking water infrastructure.
So can we set the scene about what was happening until then?
Yeah, I mean, also to add, I should say that we've got this idea about how progress works. So you expect there to be a scientific discovery, and then we work out, okay, what kind of interventions do we need to improve people's health? At this time during the Victorian period, it was really unknown what was the cause of these deaths from typhoid. So you had to really make some educated guesses at the time and try out some improvements. And what the Victorians were really keen on was to remove water that was hanging around and improve drainage. So there was this idea of miasma and having smelly air causing disease. But that actually did have some impacts, in that the reforms that they put in place did actually give us clean water. And so it's quite an interesting story that even though you don't know the causes of the problem, you can still have an impact on people's health.
Or perhaps you're correct, even though you think you know the causes, yeah, and the causes may be wrong, you can still have an impact. I mean, the first real proof that we now say is the discovery of typhoid as a waterborne disease occurred in 1856, but it's not as though everybody accepts this new knowledge immediately. It took a long time for it to kind of percolate through the scientific circles, through public health circles. And in Oxford, it's really the conversion of these leading scientific men, because it's the Victorian age, Henry Ackland and his followers, to this waterborne mode of transmission that pushes city authorities to take up a huge credit in the 1870s to reform the sewage infrastructure.
I mean, that's a massive project, isn't it, to put in enormous pipes underground in that age when engineering was definitely a bit more backward, a bit more difficult, and that the cost obviously would also be enormous. The problem areas also were based around the slums, weren't they? And Oxford University students seem to fare a bit better. Can you tell me about how you show that in your exhibition?
Yeah, so the exhibition is not just about typhoid, but it's also about how typhoid is a kind of biosocial problem. So it's both a germ, but it also spreads specifically in specific social circumstances. And Oxford has got this really pronounced history of town versus gown tensions going back centuries. And in the 19th century, what was the case was that the university had a slightly better water supply coming out of Hinksey with an incredible engineering feat consisting of lead pipes and elm encased pipes that cross the River Thames. And we actually show some of these elm pipes that were also used in London in the exhibition. So they were slightly better protected from typhoid, but because the city is so concentrated and so low-lying, that protection was minimal. So in a way, yes, they try to invest in personalized protection, but because of the social circumstances and because, for example, the family of Alice Little lived right next to one of the city's worst slums, St. Ebbs, that protection would only ever go so far.
So what happened to them, and how did they, until then, get rid of their waste? Because I think one of the big problems is that they pumped it back, straight back to where it came from.
Yeah, I mean, Sam's the expert on the cesspools.
Yeah, well, actually, so all of the sewage outflows were going straight back into the river, and then further downstream was where the water supply was coming in from the water plant. So it was really putting your waste back into the water supply, and that was something that wasn't resolved until the late 1800s. So people were still getting very sick from that form of transmission.
So it would go in what, via pipe, or how did it get into the river?
So via pipes, yeah. So it was being flushed through.
Well, partially, right? You know, it's half of it would be medieval sewers. So the city does have a kind of limited system of medieval sewers that discharge, for example, at Magdalen Bridge into the Cherwell. It's actually also one of the public bathing spaces, so people are also swimming in their own sewage during this period.
Nice.
And at the same time, a large part of the city is using so-called cesspools or cesspits. So these are underground vaulted containers, basically, into which people poo. They deposit their feces into these containers, and because these containers leak, they start contaminating the groundwater and the river water around them. And because over 90% of the city during this period is relying either on well water or on river water directly for its drinking water, this is a huge public health problem during this time. And that's also something that Ackland and Little really set out to address, alongside obviously also supportive city authorities.
And Oxford was also very progressive, because once they'd made these breakthroughs, they were then quite pioneering, weren't they? Did other cities follow suit?
I mean, there's the perpetual rivalry between Oxford and Cambridge. And as soon as Oxford starts investing in the sanitary infrastructure, all of the city reports are that they are doing so much better than Cambridge. And that Cambridge is a really awful place to study and an awful place to live in, and that Oxford now has this progressive reputation. The reason, however, for this was that Oxford was in a way forced to act also because of a series of scandals which hit the town. So Little had just become vice chancellor of the university when several undergraduates died as a result of contracting typhoid in lodging houses. This was the first time undergraduates were allowed to live outside of college. And that really created a security and publicity hazard for the university, because the Lancet came out and said, Oxford is not safe to live in. Don't send your children to Oxford to study. So the university was forced to act. The city authorities were also really concerned about the reputation. And this is the last factor, they also saw an opportunity to tap into a lot of cheap money. that the British government was making available during this time to really upgrade their sanitary infrastructure.
Now, I think the royals also had something to do with it. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, so Prince Leopold, he was an undergraduate student here.
And he was Queen Victoria's son.
Queen Victoria's son. And he became ill, suspected typhoid while he was in Oxford. And so the blame was placed on possibly his lodgings and having kind of drainage that wasn't sufficient and smelly air, so poor ventilation in his student accommodation. But that was never really established as a fact.
But it still made headlines.
It still made the headlines, and also three undergraduates who died from typhoid was front page on most of the big newspapers at the time. And that really drew in attention to Oxford as an unsafe place to be.
So tell me a bit more about typhoid itself and the symptoms you might get and how it affected you, and I suppose how many people survived if they did get typhoid?
Yeah, so the symptoms that you'd get from typhoid are normally a characteristic rash, so it's kind of like a spotted rash on your belly, it would be quite apparent, and also a very high fever. Which would come in waves, and also generally feeling very unwell, either having diarrhoea or constipation, and a few people might throw up as well. So it's a very unpleasant thing to have, and if you don't get treatment, one in five people would have died.
So those symptoms just carried on until they died?
Yeah, you'd kind of have problems with your intestines, and then some people would die out of the people who got ill.
And so, what kind of difference did this infrastructure in Oxford make to those numbers? And because presumably this was way before a cure was discovered.
Yeah, so these kind of water and sanitation improvements were having a real impact. And on a yearly basis, about 15 people would die. That was the reported figure. Up to 15 people would die from typhoid in Oxford each year, and that went down to nearly zero by the turn of the century.
Okay, because there were other horrible diseases around at the same time, but typhoid was worse because it came back. Is that the case? Like cholera was more instant?
Well, so there are many killers in the Victorian age. If you go through the mortality reports, you know, the death reports every week, you'd get the deaths of people from all age groups, from all manner of diseases. Typhoid was especially prominent during this time, not so much because it was the greatest killer, but because it was a disease that you really didn't want to have associated with your city. It was filth-borne, it was a disease of quote-unquote barbarism, you know, you didn't want to have that disease associated with your city. So after cholera, which is, you know, it's explosive, it kills rapidly, but then it also disappears, typhoid kind of was a slow-burning reminder of the need to improve your sanitation infrastructure. And it later on also became a signifier that you were a progressive city. If you didn't have typhoid, it meant you clearly were doing things right with your sanitation, you were progressive, and you were a kind of good Victorian city. And actually, one of the things we really try to emphasize with this exhibition is that this kind of stigmatization of typhoid, you know, as something that you don't want to have, that is primitive and backward, has also in a way enabled a neglect of typhoid in areas who just can't afford the sanitary infrastructures that are necessary to get rid of it. So many people in the UK now think of typhoid either as a disease of the past, right, that's something your great-grandma could have had, or they think of it as a disease of the countries they travel to. But they don't really think of it as a disease that was once very present in their own cities, and also a disease that could come back again if we continue to neglect fighting it in the global south. So that's also really one of the main points of the exhibition, to raise awareness about that.
So where is typhoid still rife? Is it third world countries where you were talking earlier about the tests and that you were doing on a much more modern, obviously modern day trial? Where was that? Tell us about that.
So the tests for the new typhoid vaccine were going on in Oxford. So 100 people drank live typhoid in 2017 to help test how well that vaccine worked. And it was shown to be very effective and has started to roll out in countries where typhoid is still a big killer. So there's been a big outbreak in Pakistan over the last 2 years, and now over 10 million people have been vaccinated using that new vaccine, against typhoid, and other countries in that region are also affected. So India, Nepal, also in Africa, Malawi is another country.
Now this vaccine's important, isn't it, because a lot of the previous cures have they become immune to. Is that the case?
Yeah, so we have antibiotic resistant typhoid, and that's posing a big problem because antibiotics are the main treatments that you would use to cure people with typhoid, and that's just not working now, so we've got a big issue on our hands.
So in a way this is a wonderful celebration of things going on in Oxford now about curing the current situation, but also looking back at how we were very progressive the last time there was a major bout. Was it the last time there was a major bout?
Well, the last time was 2017, right? That was the last officially NHS-registered mass outbreak in England. That was in Oxford, but it was a controlled one. So what this exhibition is about is minimizing our emotional distance in this country to typhoid and other parts of the world. And our goal is to emphasize the need to really show that helping poorer countries tackle typhoid is not just something that is, you know, that we should do on the basis of altruism, even though that is also a valid reason, but also in our own self-interest. Typhoid is rising again. The antibiotics we are using to treat it are no longer as effective as they are, as they used to be. And these new vaccines offer a kind of breathing space. They allow us to keep typhoid levels down in these countries, but typhoid will not be permanently controlled without investments that allowed Victorian cities to tackle typhoid with the help of clean water and sewage. So it's really, it's a call to action, and it's also a way to kind of put a human face on typhoid by linking it to one of Oxford's most prominent historic inhabitants.
Brilliant. So tell us where and how and when we can come and see it.
Okay, so you can come to the Western Library now already. So the exhibition is out and we're concentrating on the history of sanitation here in the Western Library. And then across the road at the History of Science Museum from the 21st of January, you're going to be able to see the second part of the exhibition, which focuses on the scientific development of vaccines.
And how long does that go on for?
So the exhibition at the Western will end in the middle of March, and the exhibition at the History of Science Museum will run until July. And we're also delighted to announce that the Museum of Oxford, which is about to open in winter 2019-2020, will integrate parts of our exhibition as a kind of permanent display. So if you want to learn about sanitation and water, come to the Western. If you want to learn about vaccines, antibiotics, and all of the cutting-edge science that's being done in Oxford now, but also in the past, go to the History of Science Museum.
You've also got an amazing programme, haven't you, of events and speakers and fun for kids and all sorts of things. Where's the best way of finding out about that, and give us an idea of a few events going on?
Okay, so the best way to find out is to go on our website, www.typhoidland.org, and go onto the events page, and we've got everything listed there. The first big event will be our activity day, which is on the 25th of January on a Saturday, and that's really aimed at families, but anyone can come to take part in activities about how do diseases spread, how do vaccines work, and also what's the importance of sanitation, water and hygiene.
I think there will even be a walking salmonella bacterium, so you know.
Yeah, oh well.
Yeah, definitely come by. You may be infected.
Something to look forward to. Okay, brilliant. Thank you very much, guys. Thank you for your time.
You've been listening to a podcast from oxinabox.co.uk with Catherine McAllister. Read more at oxinabox.co.uk.